Hey, this is John Williams. Thanks for finding the Mincing Rascals again. Is there a difference between an investment in a community or a lobbyist fee or a campaign contribution or a bribe? This is a hair worth splitting. And the Mincing Rascals are calling Mayor Lori Lightfoot on that. We get to the Northwestern University students, too, who are getting an education in the most painful and public ways. And why did our Austin Berg refuse for years to walk through the body scanner at the airports? Wait till you hear this. Oh, and a real favor now. Seriously, we're pushing to grow the Mincing Rascals again. Are you telling your friends and enemies to listen to us, too? I sure hope so. Tell them how easy we are to find, including just by telling your smart speaker, play the Mincing Rascals. Today is Thursday. It is November 14th, 2019, 11:12 in the morning. Hi, I'm John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals. It's our weekly podcast we record at WGN Radio. You can listen for me weekdays from 1 to 3 on WGN Radio. Hello, Austin.
Hello. Should I introduce myself?
Slate yourself, sir.
I'm Austin Berg, Vice President of Marketing at the Old Man Policy Institute and co-author of The New Chicago Way.
The long-lost Austin Berg, who hasn't been with us for a while.
I was out for 2 weeks, and I got a promotion, so now I'm Vice President.
Yeah, I didn't notice. I don't remember you introducing yourself that way previously.
I had a lot of extra time.
You get to go to funerals now as Vice President?
Does that come with a little bump in salary, sir?
I don't know. We'll have to discuss that off-pod. But yeah, it's gone. I had a good couple of weeks. I was out in Colorado Springs getting my Charles Koch chip re-implanted in the back of my head, and then last week I was talking with some Russian journalists at Columbia College, which was really cool.
Colluding with MIS.
Go ahead, Eric Zorn.
Yes, I am Eric Zorn, the proudly shifty columnist from the Chicago Tribune.
Go ahead, and
no,
what?
No, and I'm also on with Bill and Wendy every Monday at 11:30 on WGN Radio.
Steve Bertrand will join us, speaking of WGN Radio, shortly. He's still in our radio newsroom. Heather Cerrone got called into a city council meeting today. And
Lisa Donovan's on her way.
And Justin Kaufman, who normally joins us, or often joins us, was all set to join us today. He went into a Chicago-area coffee shop just to grab a quick cup of coffee. He'd parked illegally while he did so. He returned to the spot with his coffee and his car was gone.
Oh.
It's been towed, and I feel terrible for him.
He needs one of those CPD medallions.
That's how you don't get your car towed.
It sounds like material for his program.
I sent him a text, Eric, and I said, I know this is small consolation, but you just got a segment for tonight. Speaking of Chicago, we're going to start in the city. Mayor Lori Lightfoot said Wednesday that Uber has been bribing or has bribed or is going to bribe black ministers. The mayor has a plan to increase rideshare taxes. So, the mayor said, Uber offered the ministers $54 million in exchange for their support. Now, Uber did devise a different plan, which includes more taxes for taxis. They said that would generate $54 million for the city. Maybe that's where the number came from. But Lori Lightfoot doesn't seem to like their idea and, by my estimation, is sticking by her contention that they're literally offering black ministers $54 million. She said her office would actually name the names. Now, she moments ago, you said walked it back, but how much?
She went from payoffs to investments, so I don't know how much of a walk back that is. I do think it is kind of in character. She kind of went into attack dog mode and tried to do kind of a like 360 between the legs dunk on Uber. And it's not, this happens a lot, right?
There's, I didn't know this about her.
Ministers get paid off.
Hello,
in
Steve Bertrand.
Hello,
just strolling in. Hello, Lisa Donovan. Just
good
strolling in.
Morning. Hello.
Glad you guys could join us. Lisa Donovan from
the Chicago Tribune. I write the Spin Politics newsletter.
Steve Bertrand
from WGN News and the Business Lunch.
So you were saying?
Yeah, I mean, she's not wrong to point. This is a common occurrence, and if you talk to any social service organization, even, they'll talk about trying to do investments in certain neighborhoods and say we have to pay the poverty pirates or the poverty pimps. They will say that openly. And there are often payments made to ministers in public policy campaigns. Kristen McQuarrie wrote a great column the other day about ComEd in 2016 paying off a lot of ministers to get their bailout in Springfield. So it's not uncommon. It's just not clear that it happened this time.
And there's no come up with it. Didn't it come up with a big Pat Quinn bill trying
to remember anti-violence initiative?
All that money was being funneled into those communities.
Yeah, well, and the truth. truth is, excuse me, there was some coordination between these ministers and Uber that on Chicago Tonight the other night, they admitted, they said, well, we had a reverend, a minister in to talk about this, and it was coordinated by Uber. They called Uber, and Uber directed them to this minister. So the idea that there's some coordination there is not far-fetched, but this $54 million and the fact that she doesn't seem to be able to back it up, it's just weird. Politically, it's weird. You don't say something like that unless you can back it up, and she hasn't backed it up.
Why you got that long face over there?
I'm thinking about whether it's sort of, you know, the payoff, collaboration, all of these different ways to describe it. At the end of the day, I think some of the community leaders, and a lot of the community leaders are the ministers here, are saying, hey, corporate America, pay up.
Pay up what?
Invest in our communities.
Tell me how this is different than a campaign contribution, right? If you were running for office and I was a company, I would give you money to your campaign, but then maybe you would remember me favorably when legislation comes around. How is this?
This is more like a lobbying fee, I would think.
Okay, and lobbying is okay. I don't know. This just sounds stinky to me.
What sounds stinky?
I mean, it depends on how you frame it. If you're saying that it's a payoff, yeah, it sounds stinky.
That's all you got to do.
It is all of these things. I think everything, you could call it a campaign contribution or a lobbying fee or a bribe. It's all of those things. I'm going to give you money, and then you are going to align your interests with mine in exchange for the
John
cash.
John is shocked.
I know. What's
yeah,
shocked?
I guess I'm not shocked. And
I am all the time. Doesn't make it right, though.
It doesn't make it right. No one's saying it's right. What I'm saying is that community leaders are saying, hey, they're using some leverage. Invest in our communities, communities that need it, communities that have been ignored forever and a day. They're going to use whatever leverage they have.
But I don't agree with that, because then they're being bought off. They're not saying that we think this is a bad policy for people in our community. They're saying we don't like this policy because you're giving us $54 million. Right? There's one thing to arrive at the conclusion and to work against this organically because they think it's a bad idea. It's another thing to only become interested in it when there's green waved in front of you.
The idea is to improve.
If there was green waved in front
right.
of you.
Right. I mean, I think we're trying to figure this out.
Yes. Stealing some bases here.
It's more interesting right. if the money is going to change hands, right?
Well, Parachutes asked specifically last night, he said on Chicago Tonight, I asked Uber, maybe Lyft as well, did any money change hands?
A minister we spoke with said no money ever changed hands from Uber or Lyft. Uber itself did not answer whether any money changed hands.
And he did not get an answer on that.
Did not get an answer. Which would have been easy for them to deny. They could have very easily said, no, we didn't give them any money. They did not say that.
They were fairly strong yesterday, my Wednesday afternoon, in issuing denials about the
saying that it was a payoff,
categorically false, but this is all obscuring the conversation about the real issue, which is how should we be taxing Uber, and is Lori Lightfoot's plan the best one, or does Uber have a better idea in order to keep the tax revenue up where Lightfoot wants it, but not to disadvantage some of these underserved communities? Because one of the things that Uber has done, you ask people on the South and West sides, is that those areas were very, very poorly served by taxis, and they're not all that well served by mass transit.
But how does her new plan impact poor communities? I'm not sure I understand that, unless it's by taking a Uber ride from a poor community to downtown Chicago.
Then it's real expensive.
But that does not happen very often.
That's not the point. The point is to sort of cut down on congestion downtown.
I understand that, but
that has unintended consequences, possibly, for people who are trying to get affordable transit.
That means nothing to the people
in the neighborhood.
But I'm saying, what are the African-American ministers upset about? How is their community hurt? Unless you're taking a ride to and from downtown, I don't know that they won't be paying more, right? I mean,
well, there is, and Mayor Lightfoot has
right,
said
Steve.
That there's a provision.
If you're a single rider, you will be paying more.
Not much more, and if you take a shared ride from community to community, if you take a shared ride from Englewood or Austin to another outlying neighborhood, if you take a share ride from one outlying neighborhood to another one, it actually goes down for you by the mayor's plan. Yes.
Which is good. I mean, and that's what this thing I was going to bring up, which is that Lightfoot has argued that if you do share rides, you are going to save money. And again, I mean, this is sort of independent. This argument is independent of the big issue that Lightfoot raised by talking about the $54 million. But it is interesting to talk about what kinds of incentives and levers can we and should we put into this Uber Lyft system, the ride-hailing system, in order to cut down on downtown congestion and yet maintain this infrastructure of gig economy drivers in these underserved neighborhoods? Because I think that's important.
Well, if you want to invest in an underserved neighborhood because you're a good corporate citizen, go ahead, Uber or Lyft. I'm swell about that. But I don't see how you paying a church millions of dollars fixes congestion or even makes transportation more accessible to people in your neighborhoods or in your parishes. I mean, lucky you guys, you got some millions of dollars here, but that in no way addresses what we're talking about.
Lisa?
It doesn't fix the problem.
None of us live in disadvantaged neighborhoods, so it's easy for us to sit here and pontificate about $54 million for a community that might, where a community center might go up or an after school program might go in. We don't know that. We don't know what $54 million looks like. There's all sorts of legislation that's put out there and little tails put on the bottom of legislation that has nothing to do with, say, casinos or something like that. The point is, if they're trying to get some investment in the community, it can be framed various ways. It could be framed as a buy-off. It could be framed as sort of, okay, we're demanding now that corporate America invest in our communities.
Well, let's look at
it. We don't have any money in City Hall. We're demanding that corporate America invest in our communities. And another thing is, I heard from some callers after we talked about this originally about Uber and in the neighborhoods.
She's
going
waving
to the
her
south
finger
and west
at us
sides.
Now, by the way.
No, I'm just letting you, I'm just saying that Uber and Lyft and these ride shares have not solve the problem of transportation deserts. They're not there readily. You have to wait a long time still. I've had writers tell me this. People who live in neighborhoods that are not close to downtown, these are not readily accessible to them. So it's not solving the transportation desert issue.
But it's demonstrably better, I think. And I think a good compromise might be, you know, if we're going to hike taxes to make steps toward addressing congestion, then make it revenue neutral and drop fees somewhere else. Those fees, regressive fees in Chicago, are a huge problem that Lightfoot's talked about a lot. And you can say, hey, you know, you might have to pay a little
library,
bit more for training. Yeah,
exactly. Fees, right?
I think that's a pretty good compliment.
I just want to go back to Lisa's point, though, about it, could, because we're starting to talk about this as if it was extortion on the part of the ministers that was their idea. So it's very possible that Uber went to them and said,
yes,
we've
got
$54 million. Yes. You know,
I don't believe that.
Yeah, we don't know.
Well, and to Austin's point about regressivity and so on, I think that some of these plans are talking about higher rates for the things going into downtown, which you assume generally people are taking a Lyft or Uber downtown, they're probably a little bit better off, right? And I think that one of the plans has like some of the wealthier neighborhoods, there being zones in the city where the taxes are of different different levels.
That's the Uber plan,
It's the Uber plan. And that actually makes sense to me. If you're looking to institute some sort of progressivity into this, people who live on the Gold Coast who want to take an Uber downtown, they can probably afford that tax more than someone who lives on the west side and for some reason is taking it downtown.
Well, the answer is to charge me, because I get in my car in Lake County every morning and drive downtown. I'm a big part of the problem as well.
That's coming too, by the way.
Well,
they do it in London, and
they've been talking about it here for years.
I think we should leverage the star system, and anyone with lower than 4.5 stars as a rider
has to pay more.
Double.
Okay, we'll continue to follow this story. This doesn't do this podcast any good, but the first guest on our show today, Steve, is Pastor Corey Brooks, who's going to come in.
Great.
And I said to him yesterday on the phone, I said, Corey, I understand that there's some money being thrown around. He says, well, nobody's offered me any. I said, is it true? I mean, you're tapped into the network of ministers in the South Side. He said, I haven't heard a thing about it. I said, well, do your homework. Talk to me on the radio tomorrow. So at 1 o'clock today, he'll spill. But I don't...
It'll be on the pod. You have a show, your show podcast, John, so people can listen to it.
Listen to the Thursday podcast of my show at 1 to 1:30. Maybe not surprisingly, the national press cannot seem to get enough of the story about the Northwestern Daily Student newspaper. It reported earlier this month on Jeff Sessions' talk on campus. Their reporting on that event seemed reasonable to me and fair. But there were complaints with some students about the photos attached to the story and the way students' names were accessed. And the editors worried that some of their fellow students might be subject to punishment from the university over the way the protest happened. One of the issues complicating their judgment, many of the protesters were people of color. Some of the reporters were not. The editor of the newspaper is black and agonized over the best way to cover the story. So the newspaper editorialized an apology, and then people lost their poop about it.
Some high-minded or
So you're not too exercised about the apology editorial that the student newspaper put forward?
I think that I think it was wrong. I don't think that what they stated was, I mean, they were just doing their jobs, but there needed to be a professional advisor in there talking to them. That's
The reporting was good, but about the apology.
The apology shouldn't have happened. No. But what I'm saying is everybody started, you know, hammering them hard when this is a situation where, yeah, I know it's independent of the university, but I worked for my school newspaper at the University of Nebraska. It was independent of the university, J School. And we had a professional advisor. We knew we could talk to our professors to take the temperature of something. Something failed in there. So there wasn't a pipeline to sort of bounce this off of. This was decided by a group of students. And I do think you have to take seriously what the editor said. He's like, look, you know, I'm the first African-American editor of this paper. People do not understand what it's like to be part of a marginalized community, you know, and I'm trying to sort of point that out. So I listened to him. I don't agree with the apology. I don't think we should be apologizing for what we do, but I'm not going to get after students.
Students is the key. They're students. And you learn lessons everywhere when you're in college.
Right.
And these are students who made a mistake. And presumably this will be a learning lesson for them. So, I give them a pass on that. However, I'm a little concerned that in their education at Northwestern, they didn't realize it was okay to look up a witness's phone number and call them.
Take a photo of a public
protest.
Yeah,
I mean, that they apologize for looking up people's phone numbers is crazy.
I agree. They're apologizing for basic process. That's wrong. I'm just saying I don't like the whole come down on them.
No, I'm with you. I'm with you, yeah.
All these people, this is the best journalism school, and I could have a whole podcast about how let's get rid of J schools. Northwestern, all J schools. I went to J school.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. You've been absent from this conversation.
No, I know. I bet she went to Nebraska J school and she regrets it deeply.
I don't think J schools need to exist. But anyway, continue.
Well, student newspapers.
Well, they got rid of mine if it makes you feel better at Marquette.
Broadcast schools don't. Go ahead, Eric.
Student newspapers are a great learning ground, a place where you can make mistakes. It's harder now to make those kind of mistakes in the obscurity of a college paper because everything's online. The apology was excruciating and uncalled for. And I disagreed with Charles Whitaker, who is the dean of Medill, who was on your show earlier this week, John, where he says he understood why they apologized.
I will say, not necessarily in defense of a student journalist, but this is a generation of students who have grown up watching episodes of civil disobedience, especially episodes of civil disobedience that involved people of color be mischaracterized in the media, and they are very sensitive to those mischaracterizations.
I understand that these kids felt like they were in this white-hot glare of social media contempt, and this happens. You get into this vortex where you feel like everybody's criticizing you, and you feel like, well, the way out of this, even if I haven't done anything wrong, is to apologize. I guess they still think they did something wrong. I haven't really seen the next beat on this, which is the students going, yeah, we screwed up on Sunday. We didn't screw up last Thursday. Was that when the session speech was? We screwed up on Sunday because we let this pressure get to us, and we issued a ridiculous apology.
Well, I wouldn't apologize for the apology, though.
Well,
I would just let it go.
Yeah, I guess they're just going to let
advice.
It go. But they are students, and I hope that they learn from this, and I hope that also other campus papers around the country, the fact that this got New York Times, Washington Post, all over the country. I hope that other journalism teachers, other student editors are thinking about this now in advance, saying, okay, when we have these campus protests, how are we going to cover them? And I hope that the faculty advisors are saying, you got to cover them like professional journalists. Mm-hmm. We didn't cover the G8? What was the summit we had here? G7? What was the number?
We didn't
take pictures and then go up and ask the protesters for their permission to print the pictures and then take them down because the protesters didn't want. That's not the way it works.
So I was,
and the activists on campus need to know that also. You can't go out and protest and expect to be.
I just one quick story about being a stupid student. I was nominated among many to be my student speaker at my graduation. And so, I mean, I never was close to being chosen, I'm sure, but I had a speech in my head. I can still remember some of the things I was going to say in my speech. I thank God every morning that I wasn't chosen because It would have been a disaster.
Well, what are you talking about?
I'm just not going to talk about it. You know,
you're not going to tell us what it was that you're glad you didn't say?
This happens. My little brother.
They were high-minded, you know, sort of things that are wrong, that were wrong and clearly wrong.
My little brother is in college, and he was thinking about writing an op-ed in the student paper on something. And I said, you do not type one word when you are 19 in your college paper about any social issue, period. What is the benefit?
Well, listen, I was a columnist for my student newspaper at 19.
I wrote stuff, too.
My son.
It sucked. I learned a lot. I learned so much. But the problem, which we saw with the apology, is that you are so socially pressured in college. And the most important thing in the world is that you are not ostracized from that community. And they were all feeling this ideological pressure that how they had covered these protests was wrong, and that seemed like the most important thing in the world, and like they needed to bow down to that mob mentality, and then they stepped in it and provoked an even larger mob, and I felt so sad for that. But yeah, they shouldn't have put out the apology at all.
I hate to see it when conservative complaints about campus snowflakes are validated like this, because I think a lot of the stuff about being sensitive to other communities is important. But I do think that campuses need to be places where various points of view can be heard and the debate can happen, and people can't always worry about triggering someone with an opinion that they don't agree with. And I know that sounds like it sounds like I'm coming from a different place politically than I come from, but I'm a strong believer in that kind of thing, and I'm a strong believer in the traditions and tenets of journalism, which this violated. So
this story,
boomer me now if you want.
I had to not anymore. I think it was sort of an accidental revelation of this story of how hypersensitive these student journalists are, and I think it's a function of the social media platforms that exist today that didn't back when I was making my mistakes at Southern Illinois at Carbondale. If I'd had pressure for every student, I remember one time I said something wrong or dumb or whatever it was on the radio.
Oh, we all do.
And somebody called, or the manager of the radio station said, "Why did you say that?" And I carry that around to this day. It was one call. Mm-hmm. Imagine if I was being bombarded with crap from all of my stuff.
Live, as it was happening.
I was the rare woman who was a columnist at my college paper. And I will tell you, I would get calls and calls and letters.
Telegraphs.
Letters to telegraphs. Yeah, pigeons.
Passenger pigeons. Carrier pigeons.
And it was brutal. It was brutal. A lot of it was sexist. A lot of it was mean. I mean, it's something you kind of have to live with.
To learn to live
with. Yeah, and it's horrible when you're 19.
Do you think that the other body that needs to get an education here are the students that aren't at the J school?
Yes, the activists, absolutely.
Oh, my God. Hello, you little privileged Northwestern kids.
Now.
That's the big bad world out there. And if you're going to participate in it, yeah, you're going to appear in a newspaper. What are you guys thinking?
The teacher going on strike and wanting to get all his payback. I mean,
I hadn't thought about it that way, Steve. I'll need to process.
Well, it is. If you're going to go out there and make your voice heard, then one way your voice is heard is in the local newspaper.
And the most ludicrous complaint of all was the students who complained that the reporters at the Daily Northwestern had contacted them using the student directory advance to see if they would offer comment. And they thought this was like an invasion of their privacy. And the newspaper bought it, and their editorial apologizing. We're sorry we used the student directory.
That exists in social media. Have you guys heard those commercials for Real ID?
Starting October 1st, 2020, you'll need a Real ID or a valid passport in order to fly.
They're everywhere, and they at least were in October, because that would be 1 year from when you have to get your Real ID or a valid passport, which most Americans don't have, to start traveling or going into federal buildings next October. Eric, you wrote about it. I'm inundated every time it comes up on my show. What are you hearing about Real ID in Illinois right now?
Well, I wrote about it a couple weeks ago. I wrote about my experience going to the Secretary of State's office at about 3:45 in the afternoon one day, and they turned me away saying, well, our line is already too long for Real ID. I came back the next morning. It was about 90 minutes in line, and it was just to get this star on my driver's license. And my view of Real ID globally is that it's a solution in search of a problem. We have not had any domestic airline hijacking since 2001. And why now we've got to have this super special ID that requires you to go digging through your papers to find your social security card and various proofs of identification and your passport is kind of crazy to me. I think it's unfortunate that the Secretary of State's office is going to have to bear this the cost of dealing with what's going to be a cluster arrangement going forward, because it takes a long time to process these things, and we're not ready for it. And I think it's going to be really, really wild next, like, September, when people realize that all their travel plans are going to be screwed up because they don't have a passport and they don't have a real ID.
It was pointed out on John's show through the conversation that it is harder to get this real ID than it is to get a passport, which is pretty remarkable, right? Because you can't just bring in your valid passport and get a real ID.
Everything you do to get your passport is documented on the passport.
But you have to bring in other stuff in addition to your passport to get your real ID.
Right.
Which makes it harder.
But you can still use the passport to fly.
Yes.
Right.
So what's the point? It's exactly. Like, if you could just bring in your passport and it's okay, here's your passport, good, here's your real ID, it could be a 10-minute exchange. But you've got to go through this entire, you got to get your photo taken again. You got to go to this counter where they scan in all your information. They were scanning my W-2 forms. It was crazy. Yeah. And I don't blame Jesse White or Dave Drucker. I don't blame Illinois Secretary of State. They were told they got to do this. And you know, they're going to have to staff up.
Where were all you guys when the body scanners came out and all the libertarians were so mad about it? I could have used you guys at that time. The security theater is awful, and it continues to this day, and it keeps expanding, and it's terrible.
You don't like
terrible.
Body scanners?
No. I had maybe a two-year period where I wouldn't do them, and then I was just like, this is absurd.
Why
and
would
I,
you
I
not
relented.
Do them?
Because philosophically, I was like, this isn't keeping anyone safe. I'm going to make a point here, and I'm 2 hours early for
this
flight.
Well, you're a lot of fun to stand behind in
exactly.
line.
Right. All his traveling companions are like, oh,
what did you do when you were protesting for 2 years, the body scanners?
Oh, so I would have these such awkward experiences. There's a person at O'Hare who felt me up and said, are you a dancer? There's one lady who said, look at this tall glass of milk. I mean, it would happen all the time, and they would pat you down, and it's, you know, it's weird people patting you down. So,
well, who's the weirdo in that story?
I'm weird too. I'm just saying, I could have used some backup for this whole security theater. I haven't gotten a real ID yet. I've been putting it off for so long.
Are you a passport? Are you a dancer?
Because you are a tall drink of milk.
I'm not. Guys, this isn't helping. It's going to happen again at the airport.
You're triggering him. Look out.
Me too'd on the podcast.
I am. Yeah, really.
Yeah.
Get a passport, because then you don't have to have a real ID. The passport will function in every way a real ID will, as I understand it.
Yes, you're right. It will, except that you're going to forget your passport on your way out the door. You know this is going to happen. Maybe not you, John.
Oh, God,
or either,
are you kidding me?
But
drive to the wrong airport.
People are going to show up. They go, look, here's my driver's license. I am who I say I am. And they go, we can't let you on because you left your passport at home. And only 42% of the population has a passport, which just seems high to me.
The fix, Eric, though? I mean, has been set in motion a long time ago. It is post 9/11. Would you prefer they just cancel the whole program?
Yeah, I would prefer they cancel it. And in fact, the program was instituted in like 2005.
Yeah, I was
going to
say it's 20 years past 9/11. And has anyone used this to do anything?
We had had real ID, it would have been prevented.
But I mean, right. So, and we haven't had it for 20 years, and it hasn't been a weapon used against us.
Exactly.
So.
That's why I say it's a solution in search of a problem. And it was the Trump administration that decided that we're going to finally enact it. So there are a bunch of states that have, but Illinois was one of the ones that just did not. And so
we were late to the game.
So
we really dragged our
heels. Guess is that what's going to happen is next September, President Trump, if he's still in office, will say, look, I'm going to postpone this for another 5 years because this is just too crazy. And everyone's going to go, thank you, President Trump, for not putting us through this.
Let me ask you this.
It's going to be a nightmare for voters and citizens, everyone, and they're going to blame Trump if I have anything to say about
it. Last thing about that. If we'd had real ID, do you think that would have stopped 9/11?
No.
I don't know. They got on the plane somehow.
With passports, I'm assuming they were all foreign nationals.
They were all foreign nationals. So they're all here legally.
They would not have been eligible now that you mentioned
it. Evidently, some of them had fake driver's licenses, but I don't think that had anything to do with their ability to buy tickets or get on the airplane. So,
one last thing before we do go to Trump land and the impeachment effort. Does anybody have much to say about lobbying bans at the city or state level? When I get to be king, this happens like that. If you're an alderman, if you're a state representative, if you are an elected official, even if you work for an elected official, in no way can you have any employment that would be constituted as lobbying. How hard is that?
It's very hard, but it might become less hard because Luis Arroyo, who is under arrest and soon to be under indictment, was lobbying the Chicago City Council for gaming interest while he was a sitting state lawmaker. you should absolutely never be able to hold, especially at the state level, an elected position and essentially be able to cash in on your political influence in that way.
But it wasn't his lobbying that was against the law. It was him taking cash for it, right?
Right, exactly. But, yeah, but that precipitated,
that it, yeah.
Exactly, precipitated the image of this influence. It's exactly the same dynamic that happens in the property tax appeals game, which is, are they doing anything illegal? No, but the fact that they are a political player gives them the perception, if not the reality, of influence in the property tax appeals game.
Yeah.
Another thing they need to do, and Illinois is one of only 14 states that doesn't have any of this, is a revolving door ban. You can't leave the legislature on a Tuesday and come back on a Wednesday as a paid lobbyist for ComEd or whoever. And I was actually, two weeks ago, I would have told this on the podcast, I was getting my shoes shined, which is a sentence I've never said before in my life.
We're learning so much about
it. This is a very personal episode.
Right. You did it at the airport.
Yeah, I was at the Monadnock building, and I ran into a former state lawmaker who, if you Google this person's name, they will come up as writing a column on everything that's wrong with Springfield because they left the legislature for health reasons and then came back as an energy lobbyist 2 weeks later.
And he's shining shoes now?
And wait, so what's the purpose of the story? You bumped into this guy
he punched you in the nose? No, he shook my hand nicely. This is Illinois. So, you know, it's all very under the radar stuff.
And in his palm was a...
I joked over your point, but he resigned from the legislature, he said, for health reasons.
And then became an energy lobbyist. And he was, of course, sitting on, you know, the energy committee while he was... And this happens with dozens of people who are now ComEd lobbyists and are now being raided, and ComEd's being subpoenaed over their activity. This should be an easy fix. And Pritzker should be leading the charge on this, and he's been completely silent.
Has he been completely silent?
He said he's outraged about corruption.
That's Ukrainian.
Let's jump now into the impeachment hearings that are taking place even as we speak and began yesterday. I posted on my Facebook page the editorial from the Wall Street Journal and next to it the one from the New York Times. Less hyperbolic than MSNBC, even CNN, and certainly Fox News. I thought it was really interesting. The New York Times played it straight for the Democrats, and the Wall Street Journal gave you all the talking points you need if you are on Team Trump. What jumped at you guys based on the hearings yesterday?
I don't think it moved the needle. I think that everybody is in the exact same place they were before this thing started at 10 a.m. yesterday, 9 a.m. Chicago time.
Well, I was really struck by the constant complaints that the Republicans were making about all the hearsay witnesses, the hearsay testimony, because the witnesses yesterday, neither of them had ever spoken to President Trump, and many of the other witnesses who were going to come forward have not had direct knowledge. They're complaining about this, and as the violins are playing the sad song in the background, you realize, as Congressman Quigley pointed out, that the White House has prevented all the people like Mick Mulvaney, from testifying. These are the people who are firsthand witnesses, who are not hearsay. They were in the room when it happened. They've prevented these people from testifying. So you can't complain about there being only hearsay witnesses when your team is preventing.
And hearsay is used all the time.
And hearsay is used all the time. It's a bit of a red herring. But I think they are making some headway with people who are just barely paying attention. Like, hey, these guys never... You know, this is all secondhand information, and I think that point is seeping in. If you want it to seep in, and I pretty much agree with Lisa that not a whole lot changed. There was a couple of little developments yesterday. But,
well, there was the quote unquote bombshell, which looks more like hearsay, and I didn't know that it was all that revelatory. That what was it? Taylor's assistant heard Sondland on a phone call say that
the president was interested in what was going on could with hear the investigation.
Could hear the president's voice.
Yeah. Yeah, there's reporting out today that there's a second person who heard that as well.
If that's the bombshell, I hate to sound like Jim Jordan here.
This is what I can't believe, and you're their star witness.
I don't know how much you got. You're not moving the needle very
far. The thing is, you still know that this is what happened. There's just too many accounts that this is what happened, but there's enough plausible deniability on the part of for the Republicans to say, well, we don't have an eyewitness to President Trump saying, yeah, let's squeeze these guys for this. You don't have that yet. That is at least something for the senators to hide behind.
What do you think?
I think, I wasn't expecting to say this, but impeachment is boring until you get that, because it's going to be most of the Democrats are going to vote to impeach and remove. Most Republicans are going to vote no on impeach and remove. If you don't have what Eric is talking about, what do you think about when Quigley said hearsay is more valuable than direct?
Countless people have been convicted on hearsay because the courts have routinely allowed and created needed exceptions to hearsay. Hearsay can be much better evidence than direct, as we have learned in painful instances, and it's certainly valid.
Why did he say that?
In the context of, say, Republicans using hearsay as a red herring.
You know, I almost think it doesn't matter what some of the principals say. It's what the principals did or tried to do. For instance, the fact that the aide eventually went through is seen by some Trump supporters here as sort of a vindication for their side. And then I forget who the Democrat was, but he said, well, tell all of the people that are in jail for unsuccessfully trying to commit crimes that it's not a crime if you weren't successful.
And I want to point out that this aide came to Ukraine 2 days after Politico did a big bombshell expose about the whistleblower and the phone call. So it's not like the aid just naturally flowed. The aid flowed because they realized this was a problem. They panicked and they sent the aid. So let's not get too excited about that. But again, these are sort of fine points, and I don't know how much the public is paying attention. That was a little boring yesterday. I watched it at double speed on YouTube. So that's
you did.
I did.
You have long listened to and watched things at 2x just so you can get more done during the day.
That's right.
My wife says about your wife, Eric must be exhausting to live with. You know, he's sitting there listening to things on 2X, going, so that he can then write and do and tweet and post and do. You're like, there must be three of you.
I would not deny that. I'll have to ask Johanna about that.
I can't get past, too. It is boring, but I couldn't get past to watching the... I'll have to try this 2X thing now, but
Don't do it for more than 30... It turns your brain to mush.
Yeah,
don't do it.
I would think so.
Jim Jordan is a challenge at 2X, I have to say.
He lives at 3.
Right.
I couldn't get past the fact that it was almost sort of this... I was expecting the some of these lawmakers to turn to the camera and say, okay, American people, this, and this. It was a very deliberate sort of address to the constituents, to the American people. Like, I'm not just sitting here asking questions and trying to elucidate the answer. I'm going to explain this to you because you are the ultimate jury. We're less than a year out from a lot of these folks going into the election, and I think that there's a big concern that they look foolish, that they look like they're overreaching.
Did they look foolish or overreaching to you?
I'm not saying that, but I think that there's a concern about it.
Yeah.
I think they want to make sure that they don't look like, you know, that they're playing their cards correctly.
Which, do you agree with me, made the process more civil. It was not hyperbolic. I thought it was a pretty sober presentation, however scripted, of the two sides, and I found it helpful, if boring. I wasn't as bored by it as you guys were, evidently.
Well, in Illinois, we got like three corruption stories every day, and there's wiretaps, and there's all this cool stuff.
It was repetitive. I would not say that. I mean, boring is... It was repetitive. It was like, what, about 6 hours of testimony, something like that? And even at double speed, it just felt like they were repeating. They were repeating themselves a lot. There's only so much you can say about this. They would ask one of the witnesses, like, don't you think, you know, Donald Trump is a scumbag who needs to be impeached? And they're like, hey, you know, well, I'm just a fact witness here. They just want to. There is so much theater to it, but there weren't. I would take your point. There weren't like fireworks. There weren't. I was like, at one point expecting maybe Schiff to turn to Jordan and, you know, or Nunes and say something like, you know, your mother or something.
But I was also somewhat encouraged by the demeanor of the two witnesses, Kent and Taylor. Those are the people doing the hard work behind the scenes. Did you know who the ambassador or senior State Department official was on Ukraine before this? Maybe you guys did, but I sure as hell didn't, and most people didn't. And I am cheered a little bit to know that there are those sorts of people who devote their careers to doing that, and it's important work. And when they sat down, they were not advocates for one side or another. Did you get the feeling they were partisan, that they were doubling down and rooting for a side?
Chris Wallace of Fox News made the good point that it helps when your voice sounds like Edward R. Murrow.
It does.
Which it did. Maybe not on 2X. It probably sounds like, you know.
It sounds like Alvin Pillsbury and the Chipmunks. Yeah.
These guys are just answering the questions. When yes would do, that's all they said. They didn't say yes and then try and further the point the Democrats were making. I thought they were very neutral in their presentation. So if the facts are damning, it's not because these guys are working for one side or the other.
My feeling is that nothing's going to move the needle on this until you get like a John Bolton coming in, and Bolton is resisting testifying, or if you get a Mick Mulvaney under oath, and they get President Trump saying in the middle of the summer, we ain't giving the Ukrainians any money until they open an investigation on the Bidens, which I totally believe that he said. But unless you get that, I don't think any of the public is going to move on
this. I think if he said that and you had it on tape and you played it yesterday, it wouldn't have moved the needle that much either. I think a lot of the 39%, I think, would still say, hell yeah, investigate the Bidens. That's what we that's what he said should be done. We're out of time. Lisa, Eric, Austin, Steve Bertrand, I'm John Williams. I'm getting the rep from producer Elif and others. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.